everybody. First of all, if you could take a second to silence or turn off your cell phone, that can get very disruptive during the lecture. Second of all, I want to take a minute to thank the Hudson Park Branch Library, who has very generously donated this space to us this evening. That was very nice of them. That said, my name is Corey Fabian Borenstein, and I'm the Program and Administrative Associate at the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation. As many of you know, we're a nonprofit organization that seeks to preserve the historic and cultural fabric of our neighborhoods in Greenwich Village, East Village, Millville, and South Village. And in addition to having lectures like this one and other kinds of educational walking tour film screening programs, we also have an in-class education program for elementary and middle school students. And we work to maintain and extend the historic fabric of our neighborhoods. And if you want more information and more details about what we do, I would direct your attention to that table over there, where there are newsletters available, so you can read all about the things that we've been doing recently. Also on that table, you'll find a Village Awards nomination form. Our Village Awards are at our annual meeting in June, and if there's someone special or something special in the neighborhood that you want to nominate for really making the village what it is, you can fill out a nomination form, and we'll take a look at it. Also over there are program feedback forms. If you could take a minute at the end of the program to just fill that out and tell us what you liked, what you didn't like. Cell phones, for instance. You can reply to them all, and I'd love to hear what you thought of the program and the ways in which we can improve. So also over there, I just want to point out Jane is from Mobile Libris, and she will be selling the book at the end of the program. So if you're interested, go over there. So, that all said, it is now my pleasure to introduce Joan Shankar to you. Joan has been called America's most original female contemporary playwright and began her career as a child actor in Seattle. Since then, she's written a number of plays, including Signs of Life, Cabin Fever, and The Lodger. Apart from her plays, Joan is also an accomplished biographer, writing about Oscar Wilde's interesting niece, Dolly Wilde, in a book called Truly Wilde, and most recently, about Patricia Highsmith and the talented Miss Highsmith. This last was already been hailed as the definitive biography on Highsmith. So please join me in welcoming Joan Shankar.
Thank you very much. I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. We're going to do it quite quickly, and then we'll get to what I always think is the most interesting part of every lecture, questions from the audience. That's where you find out what I really know and where I find out what you know. Let me just say quickly, I'm particularly delighted to be here at the behest of this society. Like the subject of my book, Patricia Highsmith, I am given to taking inspiration for my writing from walking through Greenwich Village. And as I once again took the walk of shame down McDougal Street and saw what NYU had done to the Provincetown Playhouse, I was reminded of how important these buildings are, not just the brick and mortar, but what the great literary philosopher Kenneth Burke called the implicative character of the buildings, that is, how they inspire people. And there's one other thing, and I think of this only because I'm also a playwright. Every single word anyone has ever said in the Provincetown Playhouse is still in the walls of that building. The physics of sound tells us that language, sound, simply slows down after it's uttered. It gets trapped in the walls, the ceilings, the floors. So every single bit of language is there. And when a building is destroyed, you destroy not just the physical building, not just the inspiration it provides us, but the auditory history of that place, the vibrational history. And that's what has inspired artists forever. So bravo to this society. And it's a pleasure to be here. Lovely pictures for you, pictures no one has ever seen before of the great dark lady of American letters, Patricia Highsmith, an imagination formed right here in Greenwich Village, as you will see. The 20th century had two wonderful cultural ideas. One of them was called Paris, and one of them was called Greenwich Village. And when I was the only 14-year-old existentialist in Seattle, Washington, all I wanted to do was go to Greenwich Village. And I've been here for decades. like my subject. I'm going to start with a quick history of Pat's life so that you know how much her imagination was shaped by the village. Here she is in the picture they would not let me put on the cover of the book. Why? Because she was smoking. So I had to put a picture of myself smoking on the back of the book. There's a wonderful little red pointer here which they show. Oh, yes, here it is. This is her 1956 Olympia Deluxe portable typewriter, The Color of Coffee. She wrote all her wonderful books on it, wonderful, terrifying books on it, and kept it all her life. It traveled with her everywhere. Highsmith in Fort Worth, Texas, where she was born 9 days after her mother divorced her father, which allowed her to say that she was born out of the wedlock, but still legitimate. This is a classic attitude, I think, that people don't appreciate about her. That tone stuck out, prevailed in every single one of her novels. Her very important grandmother, who ruled her life for her first 6 years, her mother was an illustrator, a professional artist, very unusual in those days. She took off 3 weeks after Pat's birth to find work in Chicago, left her with her grandmother. Pat absorbed all those Calvinist principles that had given America the signatory shibboleth that's directed us, which is the great American dream. And if you read every book of Highsmith's, you will find in it some dark, twisted version of the American dream. The Talented Mr. Ripley, for instance, is the best critique of capitalism I have ever read in my life. A young man, given a mission to return a rich wastrel to his father, murders him instead, takes his identity, and becomes increasingly handsome and more successful the more crimes he commits. You can't do better for a critique of capitalism. This is Pat Highsmith's mother. That pose says it all. She was a contemporary of Zelda Fitzgerald, came right out of Alabama with the same attitudes, the same hopes, and experienced the same brokenheartedness. She was the love of Patricia Highsmith's life, and it's never a good idea to fall in love with your mother. This, when Pat was 3 and a half years old, her mother married this nice, mild-mannered gentleman, also an illustrator. Pat took one look at him and wanted him dead. And from the age of 3 and a half, which is when she first met poor Stanley Highsmith, and I do say, well, my sympathies are really with him, to have this evil seed. Believe me, she was a powerful child against you. Couldn't have been fun for him. All her life, she dreamed of killing him. And managed to murder again and again in her book. She was an artist. She didn't have to kill anyone. She only had to pick up her pen. This is Highsmith's father, whom she didn't meet till she was 12. Before his mustache, before his marriage, and before he abandoned his only child, there's not much known about him. He too was an illustrator, so she came from an artistic family, and until she was 22 or 23, she thought she would be an artist. But so divided was her character, and she really was cut right down the middle, that she, all her life, she drew and painted with her left hand and wrote with her right. So the alter ego started very, very early with her. Here is Pat with her mother on her honeymoon to Stanley. You can see her attitude. How would you like to bring that on your honeymoon? Now, Highsmith came from a family of show business cowboys. Here's her handsome cousin Dan, who was a rodeo announcer and ended up in the Texas Rodeo Cowboy Hall of Fame. So there's a wonderful sort of tradition of show business behind the family that no one had bothered to explore until someone who was a playwright wrote her biography. Here is Pat at the crucial age of 12. Around about 12, it occurred to her that she was probably a boy in a girl's body. And so she began dressing like Jackie Coogan. Here she is at an attractive 17, all tricked out, ready to ride a point to point, only she's sitting in Texas. So already she's contrasting herself to her environment, the land of the 6-gallon hat and the 6-shooters, and she's dressed up for an English hunt. Now, here we come to the interesting Greenwich Village part. One of the things I did with this book that has probably not been done before is I decided that she was far too interesting to write a birth-to-death book about, a chronological book. I decided to organize the book according to her obsessions. That's her obsessions about love, her obsessions about writing, her obsessions about death. And one of her obsessions was the making of maps. If you feel yourself lost in the world, you begin to chart that world. And that's what she did. From a very early age, she began to make maps and charts and lists of places to go and places to see and how things were located. So when her family moved to Greenwich Village, as they did in the 30s, she grew up in the, she was a child of the 30s and 40s, Greenwich Village. There were many places important to her, and I began to note them on the map, and I'll read, I have to find this little red thing. You'll see that the black places are the places in her novels. The white places are the places that were important to her in her lives. And you can see how even though after 1960, she spent all her life in Europe, all her work, except for the Ripley novels, and we'll get to that, is set in New York City or some state near it. And you can see how the places in her life and the places in her work coincide. And the biggest coincidence is right here in Greenwich Village. And I'm going to read you some addresses because I know you're all interested in Greenwich Village. Cornelia Street was a big deal because W.H. Auden lived there. I live on Cornelia Street myself, so I just had to mention it. W.H. Auden, whom she went to see in Ischia, and who wrote her a very interesting letter about her first novel, Strangers on a Train. He loved villain Bruno, didn't much like the good guy. 35 Morton Street, where Pat's long career of amatory seduction began, right around the corner here. She took an apartment there when she was 19 to get away from her quarreling parents, who were living then at 48 Grove Street, right on the corner of Grove and Bleecker. Across from them is an historic federal house, 45 Grove Street. It is said, I have no proof of this, but no proof to the contrary, that John Wilkes Booth plotted the assassination of Abraham Lincoln in that building. Juna Barnes lived there, the great Juna Barnes. Hart Crane lived there. Grove Street has always been a street of rebels. At 36 Grove Street is another really big address. The great Emma Goldman was deported to the Soviet Union from 36. The only woman to be deported for anarchy and bad behavior, bad political behavior. I'm very proud of her for that. Let's see. There's, of course, Marie's Crisis Cafe, which in its incarnate Pat loved piano bars all her life. Her best friend in high school was Judy Tuveen, also known as Judy Holliday. And in Judy Holliday and the Reviewers, her musical comedy sketch group began to appear very early at 178 7th Avenue South, which is the Village Vanguard, still there. Pat would go there all the time to support her and to cheer her on in the audience. Let's see what else we have. I'm trying to get in all the Greenwich Village stuff now. Christopher Street was crucial to her. Sheridan Square, where she would go to Cafe Society, and the Playhouse is there. And Truman Capote had a couple of plays done there. I can go on and on, but I don't think I need to. I think we all know what Greenwich Village meant to people in the 1940s. All right, here is 48 Grove Street in a very dramatic picture taken by the New York Times. They tried to make it look like Halloween. It's a nice, plain, red brick building. Sidney Hook, the political philosopher, lived there at the time, too. Here is Judy Holliday in the only picture that Pat kept of her. I wonder why she kept this picture. This is from the great George Cukor film, Adam's Rib, in which, for one second, Judy turns into a man in front of a jury. It's just a wonderful film. Anyone who hasn't seen it, run out and do so. Here is Pat in Barnard College. When they were living at 48 Grove Street, she was a student at Barnard. She held herself apart. You can see this is a yearbook picture. People called her the distinctive, the ultra. She was also the editor of her college literary magazine. Here she is, looking like an editor, surrounded by her staff. Every writer who hopes to be a writer always ends up editing their college literary magazine. This is her German friend, Rolf Tietjens, a gay man who wanted to marry her. There was a long line of them. Instead, he took this photograph. That's Pat at 21, looking awfully sure of herself. And there's another photograph of Pat. She was disturbingly attractive, both to men and women. She began having affairs with women very, very early and just bowled them over. Her favorite geometrical figure was the triangle. There was nothing she liked better than getting in between two people and having affairs with both of them. She had many. Now, this is something that wasn't really known about her until I began to do the research. Patricia Highsmith, when she graduated from Barnard College, desperately tried to get a job at Vogue, at Vanity Fair, at all the Henry Luce publications. There was something a little strange about her. Nobody would hire her. So she resorted to the comics. Patricia Highsmith was the most consistently employed female scriptwriter for comics during the golden age of American comics. This is really big because she destroyed every evidence of this career in her records. This is a woman who kept matchbooks. There was nothing she didn't keep. Her archives in Switzerland, where I spent a very expensive year and a half, were so large that the Swiss had to measure them, 150 linear feet, and I read every word. So she kept everything except the record of her 7 years in the comics. And why is that? Because she didn't want people to know that she got some of her inspiration for the alter ego, which was her signature character creation, from anyone but Dostoevsky. She always cited Dostoevsky. No, it was Batman and Superman. This is a first comic she did. It was, in fact, about Catherine the Great, but she also worked on a lot of second-rate superheroes, as you will see. Here's the Black Terror. And Black Terror is actually modeled on Superman, as they all were. He's a mild-mannered pharmacist. There's an accident in the laboratory, and zoom, he's the Black Terror. And like most superheroes, he's got a little suspicious helper. There's many interpretations that could be put on that. I don't need to do it here. We're in Greenwich Village. Okay, here's the Black Terror again, one of my favorite covers. This is a Black Terror doubling story. Again, doubling was, Pat herself was so double, and if you think of it, if you imagine yourself to be a boy in a girl's body from the age of 12, you can only see double after that. Here again, now this is just to give you an idea of where this all started. This is the first Superman cover in 1938, the first Superman comic, where he's lifting, not very expertly either, a nice car. Because Pat was working on the comics during the Second World War, most of them ended up being anti-war propaganda, or anti-German and anti-Japanese propaganda. This is a very famous cover. This cover, as you can see, this cover was in 1940, and it's Captain America knocking Hitler in the jaw. So the comics went to war long before the United States did. And why is that? Because everybody who was writing the comics was Jewish, except for Patricia Highsmith, who just happened to be a vaguely anti-Semitic and got a Jew for a biographer. So these things work out. Now, the name Ripley, we've all heard it. We know about it. Nobody knows where it comes from. Guess what? When Pat was conceiving Ripley, although she said she got the name from a men's clothing store on Fifth Avenue, which is the clothing store that all the guys writing comics frequented, in fact, she was reading Ripley comics. She was still drawing. Remember, both her parents are illustrators. So she was reading Ripley's Believe It or Not, which was published in the paper that she read. So there's no doubt that she thought that Ripley came from some of these cartoons that you see. Okay, and here's another comic she wrote for, The Fighting Yank. Looks like he's wearing a portobello mushroom on his head. Most of these were pretty badly drawn because so many of the men, and it always was men, almost always men, drawing for the comics had been drafted. Among them was Stan Lee. Pat's favorite company was Time Lee Comics, which morphed into Marvel, and somebody tried to fix up Pat on a date with Stan Lee, who's, as you know, the godfather of Spider-Man. Well, Stan Lee was interested in Stan Lee, and Pat Highsmith wasn't going to say what her sexual interests were, so they never got together, but they did work for the same company. And here's another one, The Whizzer. I don't know what he does. I think he just goes fast. Here's another one, Pyroman again, an accident in a laboratory transforms him into an electrical bolt of energy who can get bad guys and girls. And Bill King, this is a wartime comic that she did a lot of writing for, and his job was to kill every Japanese person and German he could find, and he did it in their thousands. Here's another one, Jap Buster Johnson. They did not hold back the language. He's an odd one because he's a kind of a source for Ripley too. He's born in Boston, an orphan, as were all of Pat Highsmith's heroes. Pat considered herself an orphan. His best friend and alter ego is killed by the Japanese, and after that he tries to kill every Japanese person he can find. And he often, see there he is, addressing his face here. Here's his dead friend, with whom he's clearly in love. And he dedicates every kill to his dead friend. So the comics were far more complicated than they seem to be. Another one, The Destroyer, rather weak looking here. But he's, again, an accident in a laboratory. I mean, they never change their scenario. Now, this is the only piece of paper, and I actually found this in England in a notebook that Pat had left with a lover. This is the only thing that she kept from her work in the comics, and this is for a comic book hero called the Golden Arrow, which is kind of a knockoff of the Lone Ranger. And you can see she's done a little drawing for him and made little lists of how he'll appear in the frame, and gives it this note, spice all this up with detail. Well, detail was what she was best at. So This carries over into the novels too. All comics had to be mailed with at least two little essays in them so they could get a lower postal rate. And she wrote a lot of them, and they were all written under pseudonyms. Here's one by Henry Hale, probably Patricia Highsmith. One of the things that Pat did was to make friends. She was incredibly ambitious, and although living in the village, she died to live on the Upper East Side. So she would frequent all the fancy places that she could, and here we have one of the fanciest. The woman sitting in the middle was a lover of hers, the witty, wonderful Buffy Johnson, whom I met when Buffy was in her 90s. And just a magnificent creature. Here you have Tennessee Williams, Gore Vidal, the novelist Donald Wyndham, and the great prima ballerina assoluta Tanikil LeClaire. That's the Cafe Nicholson on the Upper East Side. It was a place where people in the village went when they wanted to dress up. This again is Buffy in the characteristic pose by Edward Weston, one of the many older women that Pat attached herself to, and her constant trailing after an emotion that would give her something of the intensity that she had with her mother, she continued to choose older women. And here's another one, Rosalind Constable, the eyes and ears of the Henry Luce Corporation, a very influential art journalist. Now here is a classic village figure, the great Lil Picard. She was a friend of Pat's. Lil was a performance artist from Germany, a refugee Jew from Germany, who continued to do, here she is all dressed up in her 90s for a performance. She continued to perform and to paint and to appear in movies until she was 95. She lived at 40 East 90th Street. Here is yet another lover of Pat's, and you'll recognize this as a Greenwich Village scene, Layla Cornell, selling her drawings for dollars near her studio in Washington Square Park. That's Pat Highsmith in her 20s on the Circle Line. Here is, again, remember I told you that Pat loved maps and charts? Here's a chart she made at 25 of her lovers, comparing their advantages and their disadvantages. And she decides how the end due to my lack of sympathy and due to her lack, bad judgment on my part. Their coloring, their profession, and even how long the relationship lasted after they broke up. A really scary sentence, which is cut off here, is the very last one. From the most advantageous, I fled and was false. This woman's idea of the American dream was quite chilling. Another one of her mainline lovers, she likes society women. This woman, Virginia Kent, in her marriage photo, was one of the models for The Price of Salt, the only lesbian novel Pat wrote. And so disturbed was she to write a lesbian novel, since she didn't want to identify herself in any way, that she finally published it under a pseudonym. And when in 1990 she was persuaded to publish it under her own name, she changed the title of the book. So something about that book always had to be in disguise. Here we go. This is a woman who actually did inspire The Price of Salt, another society woman who committed suicide before The Price of Salt was published. Pat had a two-minute meeting with her in Bloomingdale's, went home in a fever of attraction, wrote up the plot of the book, never saw this woman again, but began to stalk her a bit, since stalking was one of her talents. She'd go out to New Jersey and never approach the woman, but hang around the house and look at it and take notes about it and dream about her, and recreated this woman in the only novel wrote that didn't have a murder in it. And the chilling thing is that this woman killed herself before the novel came out. So the murder is extra textual. It happened. It had to happen because it was Pat Highsmith, but it happened outside the book. Again, here's another chart. Pat, here she charted everything. She mapped everything. This is a chart she made up for the price of salt. In 1948, she went to Yaddo. You all know Yaddo, of course. And Truman Capote. Is there anyone here who doesn't know what Yaddo is? Yeah, it's an artist colony in Saratoga Springs, New York. And it was a pretty wild, a much wilder place in 1948 than it was here, than it is now. Truman Capote helped grease her in, and it was there that she revised Strangers on a Train. She lived in this room here, appropriately enough, and met this British novelist there, Mark Brandel, to whom she became engaged, desperately trying to normalize herself. She went into psychotherapy for 6 months, completely drove the therapist nuts. The poor therapist tried to get her into a group with other women who wished to alter their sexuality, and all Pat could think about was how many of them she could seduce. So that didn't work well. Here she is with her favorite cat, Spider. Now, Spider ended up in the possession of Dame Muriel Spark, another favorite novelist of mine, and Spider had a very long life. Pat dedicated a book to Spider. She loved cats. Another lover of hers in a bed, Pat has just left to take this photograph. This woman was with Pat for 4 years, a brilliant European Jew who they fought so much that Pat was inspired to write 4 books because of her. The worse the relationship was, the better the books were. And that, I'm afraid, is something that most writers would guiltily admit to finding in their own lives. Now, this is another friend and lover of Pat's, the actress Heather Chasin, in a play with the great Dame Sybil Thorndike. It's a play about a homicidal alcoholic lesbian. And Heather Chasin modeled her character and her clothing after Pat Highsmith. So it's called Call Me Jackie. It was a play by Enid Bagnold, who had actually hired a homicidal alcoholic lesbian to be her cook during the war. And so that's a bit of Pat's look there. Okay. This is Pat and Arthur Koestler, the great and very badly behaved emigre writer. They had had an affair in the early 1940s, and there they are in Alpenach years later. We're going to go through these quickly. Here she is in France. She, after she expatriated herself, she never really came back to America. She came back only to take notes on Greenwich Village, whose oddly curving streets inspired her to commit many, many crimes. And because her mapping was so interesting to me, I began to make maps myself to trace her and to track her. And as I began to make these maps, I found that wherever she lived with a lover in life is where she killed someone in the books. She was a classic Freudian. Sex and death never ventured far from each other in her art life. These are gleaners, the Barilskis, a Polish couple who lived near here in Moncourt, France, and she dedicated a book to them as well. Her famous 501 Levi's, which she sent to Texas for, like every expatriate, and I'm an expatriate myself, I live in Paris half the time, you just yearn for American things. You die for a hamburger. You kill for a pair of Levi's. You know, American mustard is just, you pay anything for it. She was the same. She was the same. Now, this is a very funny... France is the country which has honored Highsmith the most. She's a huge bestseller in all of Europe, but France actually put up a plaque for her, only they put it up about 1,500 yards away from her house. They put it up in front of the wrong house, which is perfect for Highsmith, who was a master of, you know, quick change dissimulation. Let's see what else we have. Another lover of paths, Marina Boudaram. She dedicated also a novelist. She dedicated a book to her. And Pat left Marion for this German performance artist, Tabea Blumenschein. Here is Tabea disguised as a girl, and here she is disguised as a boy. You can see why Pat was interested in her. Pat's whole doubleness was really inspired by that. Here is Pat with a cat, totally tranquilized. You had only to put her near a cat, and she calmed right down. This is in late middle age. Here she is with yet another friend, Monique Buffet. Here she is at Maxim's in Paris at a fashion show, looking very happy with a cigarette and rather well lit, I would say. She had been a heavy drinker since the age of 18 and never stopped. Here is her last house, which she helped design. I call it the Fortress of Solitude. It's in Tenya, Switzerland. It's the scariest thing I ever saw. It looks just like Hitler's bunker. This is the good side. This is the side with the windows. The front of it is a long, low, oblique swath of concrete. And that's what she felt comfortable in. So you can imagine what she was drawing on in order to create. She went to the ends of her nerves to bring back the news. But in order to do so, she had to feel safe. She called this a strong house. I think we'll just have one more picture. No, sorry, that's too... She was an expert carpenter, and she made a lot of furniture. And this pose, which looks terrifying, but which she posed herself in a rather antique mood, here she is in front of her all her instrument, her bladed instruments, the instruments with which she did carpentry. Notice the difference between that and the face we saw of Pat at 21. It's a good argument for women not to drink, I think. Here she is in front of her Library of Highsmith works. She's not looking happy. Another Highsmith, every letter she wrote was accompanied by a map. Every letter she wrote. She had to visualize everything. And her books are exactly the same. Her eyes move over the surface of objects like a camera. There's no other American writer with her imagination. Here she is with her friend Jean Moreau in the last year of her life. Characteristically, Highsmith died of two competing diseases. If you treated one, you would exacerbate the other. She was doubled right down to her death. And here is the image of Highsmith that is everywhere. This is how people think of her. The suspense writer, or the crime writer. She was not a crime writer. She was a punishment writer. Her books include the most serious investigation of guilt in American literature. There's nothing like them. And I think that's it for photos. So we could have some lights and maybe some questions and things that I haven't talked about. How are we doing for time? Are we okay?
Yep.
Yeah, I think we're fine. Yes?
I wonder if you would talk about her
notebooks.
And your book described her fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. From the age of 18, Patricia Highsmith recorded everything she did. But being double, she did it in two ways and in five languages, all of which I had to read. She kept books which she called cahiers, fancy French word for notebooks, in which she kept all her artistic ideas. Her diaries, which she kept coterminously with the notebooks, she recorded her sexual and emotional adventures in, and those are extraordinary for their frankness, for their harsh judgments of herself and other people. Her honesty is extraordinary. And also her ability to twist things around, because if she didn't keep notebooks for a while, she would pretend that she was doing so. It was how she organized the great emotional chaos under which she operated. She was an amazingly brave woman. Considering the And because I track her by her obsessions, you will see what she, if you have a look at the book, you will see what she dealt with every day of her life. Every day of her life, she wrote. She wrote 8 pages a day, and any writer in this audience will tell you that's an extraordinary amount. 8 pages a day, 5 or 6 letters, you know, and essays too. She was, among her other talents and obsessions, hypergraphic. So the notebooks are amazing. I can't think of anything else like them in American literature. Yes.
You mentioned when you went through her belongings in Switzerland, you could find nothing about the early career in the comics.
That's right.
But yet you uncovered it somehow in quite detail. How did you do that?
Well, that's a very good question. I myself have loved the comics since they were forbidden to me as a child. And when I was very young, I published something about the comics, and because of that, I have a little entree into the very weird and closed world of comics writers. And they all, there's no real museum of comics. By the way, comics are one of the 2 Native American arts. The other one is jazz, but comics is our American art. And we did steal it from the Swiss, but that's another story. I go into it in the book. It is just a fascinating world, and because I began to talk to people and was introduced, it's all very hand-to-hand. You have to know somebody who knows somebody who knows. I began to meet all these old comics writers and drawers. Brilliant, brilliant people. When I met the man who invented Captain Marvel's phrase, "Holy moly," I knew I'd confront greatness. I mean, it's just wonderful. I ended up going to all the comics conventions, so I could meet everyone. I interviewed everyone, you know, Stanley, everyone. So that's how I did it, slowly and with, you know, great. The most interesting thing about doing a biography is the people you meet and the thousands of worlds, because Highsmith belonged to so many different worlds. And because she's such a quintessentially American writer, how much more American can you get than being influenced by the comics, as well as all the European writers she adored? So that's how I did it. Yes?
What issues have you become aware of that have slowed up the migration of her works into cinema?
Money. every work she's ever done has been made into either a television film or a film in Europe. Here now, Mike Nichols has an option on Deep Water, I think a very interesting novel of Pat's, in which her real successful love interest is developed, that between two snails. The only successful description of love in any of her works. She, by the way, loved snails and kept them as pets. She had one point in England, this is how strange she was, she had 300 snails. And again, that's something I go into in the book. She was like no one else. There has never been an imagination or a character like she was supernally weird. And that's in the great American tradition, also a kind of crackpot inventors. And she did a lot of inventions, too, as you might imagine. More questions? Yes?
2 questions. Is there any way to see the notebooks other than going to Switzerland? You've got to go to
Switzerland. They will be, her publisher and... she's very lucky to have a wonderful publisher who's also now her literary executor, Diogenes Verlag. They'll be publishing my book in Germany. And they're her executives. And all her work is in the Swiss Literary Archives, which is a building that looks rather like the last fortress of solitude, her house in Bern, Switzerland, the most expensive city in Switzerland. I'm still a little bitter about that. I think they'll be publishing excerpts from her diaries and notebooks. I certainly quote rather extensively from them, just because we have no other record of a life like that. She knew from a very early age that she was going to write herself into history, and she was determined to record herself in a way that was meaningful, and by God, she did. Yeah, do you want to finish that question?
Actually, two other parts. How long did it take you to write the book? And the other question, you know, there's this book of her short stories, like 600 pages of tons and tons of short stories. And one of the things about them is that they seem to create a whole world in each story with very great economy, but they're all over the place. And so, I mean,
they're not
in America, but like everywhere.
Yeah, well, she lived everywhere. She lived in England, she lived in France, she lived in Switzerland.
States or in California, there.
Right. She traveled all the time.
She mostly wrote about.
Well, her. I was talking about her novels. The novels, which is a different. And of course, Ripley, who, in whom she confided in her deepest dream. She said fiction was for what she wanted to happen. So Ripley became her kind of alter ego, and so she kept it in France, which is where she was living. That's why. Everything else she moved to. Yeah, we have another question?
Yeah, hi. In the first Ripley novel, the sexual ambiguity of the character is really highlighted, but then in the other novels, it seems like it's downplayed. Is there any reason for that, or do you agree or disagree?
I don't disagree. Past male characters are never very interested in sex. And if they are, they usually subcutaneously fall in love with another man. Ripley, as Pat's own love life began to diminish, so did Ripley's. He really tracks her in many, many ways, and that would be one reason. She does marry him off to an heiress, a blonde heiress, whose hair looks like money. She would have liked that, but they don't sleep in the same room. Ripley doesn't really like sleeping in the room with her, so he has his own bedroom. She's very interesting. Yeah, sexual. She is more transgendered in her thinking than almost any writer I've ever seen, and long before there were words for it. She was writing away, completely unaware that she was doing anything unusual. She thought she was writing good, you know, good works. Yes, back there.
Two questions. One is, did you ever meet her? And yeah.
I did not.
And the other is, you mentioned that she was somewhat anti-Semitic. And I've actually heard that she was more than somewhat anti-Semitic.
Well, look. When you have as many Jewish lovers as she did, yeah, your anti-Semitism has to be cut by some experience. I think. And meanwhile, she's in her teens. And just as she's graduating from Barnard College, she's scribbling some anti-Semitisms in her notebook. Her best friend is Judy Holliday. She's scribbling anti-Semitism. She's taking piano lessons from Judy Holliday's mother at the Henry Street Settlement. She's scribbling anti-Semitism. She's looking for a job, and who is the only person in New York who will hire her? Sholem Aleichem's son-in-law. That was her first job in New York. So, here's how I judge it. Pat offended me on every possible level. If you think the anti-Semitism is something, you should see what she does with dogs. I'm a big dog lover. In half her novels, she kills a dog. She loved cats. That's the explanation. So there's something to offend everyone in her work, but she's really interesting, you know. And the first question was, how long did it take me to write this book? The usual answer is my whole life, and that's true to a certain extent, but it was 8 years. It takes a long time to live a life, and to write a good biography takes a long time too, because you really have to think about it. Yes?
Would you talk about her relationship to food, and what do you think that was about?
That's another good question. Highsmith, who was never completely anything, was kind of, sort of, more or less semi-anorectic, but not really. Because she was liminal in everything she did. She loathed food. Hate Evan would just get furious with people if they ate too much. No one is ever fat in her novels, but she describes food sumptuously in her works. People are always eating and drinking, eating wonderful food. And so she said when she was a teenager, she stopped eating. She understood exactly why, to control her situation. She hated her mild-mannered stepfather. Her mother seemed to hate him too half the time. There was a lot of argument. They always lived in small apartments because they were poor. And so she stopped eating to control her environment. And she always understood what she was doing, but she never did it completely. So defining her, that's why defining her in terms of her obsessions allowed me to really explore them. And that would seem to be a good way to do it. Yes?
Why did you want to write about her? Out of all the people you've been
writing? First of all, she'd been badly written about. Second of all, I'm an expatriate myself. I'm very interested in what happens to Americans who go to other countries and write. And once I got into it, I was horrified at what I found. And then I was so interested, and she is fascinating, that I would write my way through it. I thought, I'll never find another character like this, and I really felt that I had to bring her to the world. So it was a long... Yes?
You know, how did you feel, you know, in going through the whole process of, you know, researching her? Did you feel attached to her? Or how did you manage to stay detached, or did you get attached?
The relationship with the subject for a biographer is one of intolerable intimacy. Absolutely intolerable. You have to arm yourself every day. I don't find it useful to be that detached. There are certain sections are written very close in, certain are pulled back. It just depends on how the relationship, it's an evolving relationship. It's not static in any way, but it is intolerably intimate. I know more about her than her lovers, than her friends, than her parents. I know more about her than I know about myself, certainly. And that's really not fair. And so that knowledge has to be tempered with the quality of mercy, which I hope I did. Yes?
One of the stories in the book that most intrigued me, maybe you want to talk about it, is when she sabotaged her own self in going for the job at Vanity Fair or some magazine of substance.
Yes. That's right. She showed up at Vogue magazine, which was then it's essentially the comble of chic. And she showed up with out of hat in the very proper 1940s, with looking like she'd just gotten out of somebody's bed. And this is a woman who was extremely well-groomed when she had to be. But this is a job she wanted very much, but something inside her told her that it really wasn't for her. You know, that she wouldn't have lasted, so she sabotaged herself, failed the interview, and was heartbroken. But she'd do that over and over again. Her unconscious creative self would take over and sabotage a situation which wouldn't have been right for her in any case. Yes?
There's a book that was written about her by a former lover that I can't remember his name. But
oh, Mary Jane Meeker's a memory of their short relationship.
And, you know, presumably fairly subjective. Are there caveats that you would sort of say if you're going to reread the book, like what would I notice might be
biased? Well, let me remind you what Gore Vidal said about memoir. Memoir has nothing to do with history. It has to do with how the writer remembers her own history. So, and that's all I'll say about that. Yes, sir.
Why did her family move to Greenwich Village?
First of all, they all wanted to be on the Upper East Side. Greenwich Village was cheap. Well, they came to make, her mother was a real career woman. She really desperately wanted a career as an illustrator and as a painter. And Fort Worth, Texas, a cow town at the time, not neighborhood center it is now, but a cowtown. People used to say it was, you know, where the West began and culture ended. She had to get out, and also she suffered from the attentions of an extremely dominating mother. And she wanted to get out too, just like Pat wanted to get out from her relationship. Man, hands on inhumanity to man. Do we have, yes. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. She take herself back to therapy? Never, and invade against therapy her whole life after that. Nobody needs it, she said. But she is she's the most classic Freudian of all American authors. She got Freud before he revised himself, even. She got just as sexist as he was. Yeah. She didn't write about Ulrika Ottinger's films, but Tamea Blumenschein, that woman who disguised as a woman, was Ulrika Ottinger's lover, and she snatched her from Ulrika. Yes?
Do you think she defined the criminal psychopath in the public imagination? I mean, I can't remember coming in contact with any characters like that before I saw Strangers on the Train.
Yeah.
And since then, it seems it captured the type of character that's captured the imagination of.
There were women, actually women writers, who dabbled in that before she did, but she gave the most psychologically credible portrait. Certainly, and with Ripley, who really is a psychopath, she wrote the first successful criminal psychopath, one who is rewarded for his psychopathology. This has never been done in America. She turned the American dream upside down. She inverted it. Yes, sir.
Not relevant, she doesn't really sound like a joiner, but did she have any sympathy with kind of the emerging women's movement or gay liberation?
I think feminism was a term she would have used only under water torture. No, since she was 12 years old and thought of herself as a boy in a girl's body, she and another one of the ways she got me, since I'm a feminist to my fingertips, her feelings about women, she adored them, they were her inspirations, but, you know, the incredibly sexist, no sexist male would dare voice the opinion she voiced. She did, when Anita reminded me who she was, the orange juice person who... Yes. When that poor woman started to whatever she did, and Gore Vidal came out and attacked, she sort of joined Gore Vidal. She actually wrote a letter to Anita saying, "We homosexuals," a word she never used, "we homosexuals are clever as foxes. Be careful if you attack us." It was quite an interesting letter, which I found in her. So for a moment she rose to the end, and she was a huge supporter of authors' rights. If anyone was squeezing a penny out of her that shouldn't be, or was, you know, denying her some royalties, there she was. So she supported all those rights. Yeah.
She was also a supporter of the Palestinians, and she dedicated one of her books to them.
She did, but that's very complicated. That had to do with her anti-Semitism. When she came in contact with Palestinians, with Arabs, she hated them. And in fact, her book, set in one of the Arab countries, The Tremor of Forgery, which is a very interesting book, is all about how terrible the Arabs are. So all of her political opinions are suspect because they all came from some very interesting turning of her emotions. To ascribe any politic to Patricia Huston is a mistake. She was one day to the left, one day to the right. I have to say that I find myself kind of going back and forth, too. I understand that. But but nobody was as extreme as him, since she lived by extremes. Yes.
What made her so attractive? I mean, it seems like she seduced a lot of women.
She did. She was just, you know, what makes people attractive? I have pheromones? I don't know. People, I have had wonderful ladies of a certain age and distinguished old gentlemen tell me with tears in their eyes how beautiful she was, how fascinating, how they just wanted to marry her and love her. And over and over, I interviewed 300 people for this book, and believe me, I got a lot of that. I believed that she was a raving, attractive beauty. You had a question?
What did she leave her estate to?
I beg your pardon?
What did she leave her estate to?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. She left it to Yaddo. It's the biggest bequest Yaddo ever got, $3 million. And all her royalties, too. So that started off Yaddo's big capital campaign. So 9 weeks at Yaddo, and I tell the story in one of the chapters. It's very funny how the officials at Yaddo and Pat stalked each other for weeks and months trying to. It was her, really one of her best thriller creations. She would call them from payphones. She would send them donations unmarked with her name. Oh, it's just, she created a whole drama and suspense out of it, but they ended up with her estate. So we can say that she was public-spirited. Of course, she, part of it was that she didn't want it to leave it to anyone she knew. Was that, of course.
One last question.
Did she like anybody?
Oh, yes. Of course she did. And I'm just telling you the funny part. Many people were terrifically fond of her. And she was just always an ambivalent person. But she had many friends, and people still miss her. So she was human, although most things human were alien to her.
Are we done?
One more question.
Where would you recommend I start?
Oh, start at the beginning. Start with Strangers on a Train, then go to The Price of Salt and The Talented Mr. Ripley. You can't go wrong. And there's also this big book about high school.